I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, Ken Hollings on A Guide to Your Stars in his new book, The Space Oracle. Ken Hollings is a writer, broadcaster, cultural theorist and lecturer based in London. He is the author of the books Destroy All Monsters, Welcome to Mars and The Bright Labyrinth, at least a couple of which we've talked about on previous Little Atoms. His work has been published in numerous journals and anthologies throughout the world, and he has written and presented programmes for BBC Radio 3, Radio 4, NPS in the Netherlands, ABC Australia and our own Resonance 104.4 FM. Ken teaches regularly at the Royal College of Art and Central St Martins and has presented his work at the Royal Institution, the British Library, Tate Britain, the Berlin Academie de Kunst, the International Space University in Strasbourg and the Venice Biennale. Ken's latest book, The Space Oracle, A Guide to Your Stars, is what we're going to be talking about today. Ken, welcome back to the show.
It's always a pleasure to be on Little Atoms, Neil. Always a pleasure.
So tell us first of all what the idea is behind The Space Oracle.
It is an attempt to retell the history of astronomy in a very fragmented, fractured, and on occasion very personal way. I was doing research on the subject and I got fascinated by how histories of astronomy present not so much certain facts, but a kind of hierarchy of facts. And as I continued my research, I became increasingly aware of a criticism which is referred to as presentism. So there is a view that says that our histories of science, knowledge, etc. are sort of structured in a kind of pyramidal way, so that we tend to see our viewpoint as being the best viewpoint. I mean, it's a kind of Hegelian sense of progression. So here we are on this ascending curve towards whatever our mastery of the universe is going to be in the fullness of time. You know, the translation of knowledge into wisdom, as it were. But we tend to look back at where we've come from and be a little disparaging, a little dismissive. So, you know, I deliberately was bringing astrology into this story, not because I wanted to validate astrology and demonize astronomy. I didn't want to do that. It wasn't a statement against rationalism in favor of the irrational. It was saying, actually, these systems, which we tend to look almost literally down on, because they don't have the complete picture we have, we tend to see them as being in error. But if we actually examine how that view of the cosmos fits with their society, with what they require, it works. It's not false knowledge. It's true knowledge to that culture, to that society, to that civilization. So that was partly was an attempt to sort of take into account this kind of presentist criticism. And I think also to sort of inquire with what we mean by knowledge. In the book, I actually state at one point, all knowledge begins with error. And in a sense, it does. We make an assumption based on the phenomena, the observable phenomena we have before us, and we draw a conclusion. And it is almost inevitable that conclusion is going to be false. It's going to be an error. And then we slowly correct that error. But in the correction, we end up sort of being slightly dismissive of where we were before. Oh, did we really believe that old myth? And it's like, yeah, all right, it's an old myth to you now, but it was not a myth to the people that were working with it.
No, and of course, there's a point in the past where astronomy and astrology are indivisible. It's the same thing.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think when you begin to see that there is a moment when astronomy starts to detach itself, and it's beginning to see a different universe. And I'm not disparaging that either. I'm just saying that is an interesting period of emergence, which is what we should see it as. But in that process of emergence, new myths start to impose themselves, new narratives begin to emerge. And because we actually need narratives in order to make sense of all this, we attach ourselves to them. So, for example, I'm a little hard on Galileo, even though he has a sign of the zodiac entirely to him. He actually, one of the houses of my astrological array, my zodiac, is named after him. So I pay him that respect, but I am actually a little bit critical of him, because I think there has been this narrative which has emerged. And it's interesting that it comes quite late. You know, Galileo was not really here nor there until the mid-19th century, when the idea of the scientist as a division of labour, as a profession, begins to emerge. And so he becomes almost like a kind of, and people are going to hate me for this, but he's kind of like the patron saint of scientists, in the sense that he is presented as the figure of scientific authority.
But also like that lone genius thing.
Exactly. There's that myth as well. And so it builds up, certainly into the 20th century, when you get to Brecht's play on the life of Galileo, this image of Galileo as, you know, the one individual, the disciplined rational mind that says, no, wait a minute, the cosmos works like this, and the forces of reaction, you know, the astrologers, the church, sort of say, no, show him the instruments, let there be torture and death if he continues in this position. And so he's forced to sort of recant, but then he's saying, yeah, but it still moves, you know, the earth still moves around the sun. And that's fine as a myth, but you know, in the case of Brecht, he's beginning to sort of draw parallels which we still unconsciously accept, that with that change comes social change, comes cultural change, comes political change. Once we are no longer the centre of the universe, then the Pope is no longer the centre of the church, the King is no longer centre of a regime of power. And I would actually argue that we're looking at it the wrong way around, that I think changes were already taking place in the social and the political fabric, which Galileo's discoveries reflect and fit in with. So this idea that there is, you know, that there is literally a revolution taking place when the Earth is moved away from the centre of the universe and becomes a planet orbiting the sun in the solar system, there is actually more congruence there than a kind of cause and effect relationship.
You mentioned that Galileo is one of your 12 houses, yeah, shall we say. So let's talk about how this book is structured and why.
Well, I've followed, first of all, the title, The Space Oracle, is derived from a late Victorian Edwardian handbook called The Lady's Oracle, which my wife, Rachel, grew up with and absolutely loved this book. The thing I loved about it is the fact that it was supposedly written by Cornelius Agrippa, one of the great alchemists in Europe. And The Lady's Oracle was a kind of handbook which had exercises and games and pursuits that you could follow, almost like a parlor trick book, in which you could find out what your romantic life was going to be, who you were going to fall in love with, how you were perceived by your suitors or the society around you. And I, first of all, I just loved the idea of interacting with a book in that way. And it kind of reminded of how people interact with horoscopes, books of horoscopes, sun signs, etc. So that was one leap. The other one is that one of my kind of guiding spirits, one of my mentors, if you like, in this book, is the American artist Joseph Cornell. Mm-hmm. This amazing American surrealist who is best known for these beautiful boxes that contain a kind of almost a random assemblage of objects from the past. And I was thinking he would have loved something like The Lady's Oracle. It's very much his world of Victoriana and cardboard cutouts and paper patterns and bits and pieces of parlour magic, like conjuring trick objects. And also I loved the fact that he, you know, his kitchen where he worked and had his ideas, he used to stay up all night. He called his kitchen the observatory. So he always had this relationship with the stars. Finally, so we've got kind of a book that you interact with, a sense of magic, predestination, etc. And I love horoscopes. I love the fact that everybody secretly knows their sign. Even if you don't believe in astrology, even if you say, no, it's completely impossible that this system could, you know, sort of exert any kind of force on how we behave, everybody knows their sign. They do secretly if they don't believe in it. But I wanted to take it a stage further. So the book is constructed around the 12 houses of the zodiac, which have been around for thousands of years. You know, we can thank Ptolemy, one of the great sort of Greco-Egyptian astronomers, for this set of houses that we have. But I wanted to change all the names, not because I wanted to be willfully obscure, but because I wanted to remind myself, as much as anyone else, that names are only habits, they're not the truth. And so, you know, I would read an account that would say, you know, the ancient Egyptians were suspicious of the planet Mars because of its irregular movement through the sky. So there'd be a moment when it goes into retrograde. So it would appear to them to go backwards. And I'm thinking, they didn't think Mars did anything because that wasn't Mars to them. Mm-hmm. That was a point of light that moved in a particular way that they observed. And now we have it aligned with gods and with, you know, a whole set of cultural readings, so that when you use the word Mars, it's very, very loaded down with meaning. And so I wanted to sort of like brush all that away. So I gave, I kept the 12 houses in the calendar order in which Ptolemy established them in. And I also, well, I'll come to the connection with the human body in a second, but I changed all the names. So everybody who thinks they know their star sign, they now have a new name for that star sign. And the other aspect that I loved about this, the organisation of this book, is that I discovered in my research is that in the Middle Ages and certainly into the early Renaissance, apothecaries, doctors, whatever you want to call sort of medical practitioners of this era, would quite often consult astrological guides. And they would actually view the human body as a kind of walking calendar, so that, you know, as you pass from the top of the head to the soles of the feet, you actually pass through the Ptolemaic calendar. So, you know, your star sign would also be the star sign of a particular part of the body. And I've retained that. So as you read the book, you're actually also passing through the human body from the very top of the head and the eyes all the way to the soles of the feet and the connection with the earth.
As an aside, I mean, when probably back in the dim and distant past, Ken, when you first came on this radio show, this radio show was probably thematically firmly in that, in that sort of idea that there was a, you know, there was a progression of knowledge, and that, you know, things were getting better and better. And then suddenly we all find ourselves living in this, you know, crazy world of fake news and things. And one of the things that's really interesting is actually, I think entirely appropriately, astrology seems to be really fashionable again.
That's true. I believe that, for example, the Greenwich Observatory is going to do a large exhibition on the history of astrology sometime either this year or next. I don't know whether that's a straw in the wind and, you know, that there is a kind of hurricane of irrationalism heading our way. And as I said, I'm not attacking the kind of foundations of a project like Little Atoms. You know, I'm firmly with you, but I think there is a conversation going on that's not about, you know, what is demonstrably true or false. But there is a discussion about how a narrative is formed and how knowledge actually structures itself. And that's kind of the foundation of the book, is how do we shape knowledge? Because I wasn't just using Cornell's boxes or the Lady's Oracle as an organising point. I was also looking at school textbooks, all kinds of very knowledgeable accounts written of the history of science, of the history of astronomy. And I'm reading and thinking, well, some of this stuff is out of date now. Some of the books I read as a school kid don't actually match the view of the universe that we have now. Does that mean they're false? Does that mean they're untrue? Or is there a larger conversation going on? And I'm after that conversation. I mean, I couldn't have written this book if I hadn't spent a lot of time talking with astronomers, talking with people who specialise in various aspects of space medicine and cataloguing the history of science and the history of astronomy. And I absolutely defer to them. I mean, I think one of the most exciting moments I had when I was working on this book was when an astronomer whose eye was just so disciplined and so skilled could point out to, we were standing on a metal fire escape in the East End of London. It was summer and it was early evening. And he pointed to two small dots of light that was just above the, going to say the tree line, but the kind of roof line of the East End. And he said, well, there's Jupiter and Venus. And this is the closest they get. And it's so rare that you actually see these two planets seemingly in alignment, even though they're millions of miles apart. And it was thrilling. It was really exciting. And I realised My eye is not trained like that. I don't have that skill. And that's why there is actually a rather forlorn little scene near the beginning where I describe myself as a child trying to observe the moon through a pair of plastic toy binoculars and being very disappointed that I couldn't see, you know, jagged craters and rock formations. It was just this kind of yellow, blurry thing in the sky. And it's kind of a... That's the kind of reminder to me of how my eye is not trained. And I do have immense respect for those who, as someone once said, you know, astronomers never touch the subject that they're working on. They can't physically, or, you know, their physical manipulation of these things is very, very constricted to robots and probes and being able to land a satellite on a comet or whatever it is. Most of the time, they're just looking, they're observing, they're calculating. And I think that's an amazing ability. So to me, to observe, to go into my own kind of Cornell Observatory, I think I'm very good at observing things on Earth. So I quite often mention signs on vans or slogans on posters or something written on a tote bag or the facade of a museum. And so that became my area of expertise in terms of observing this universe. So no, I have massive respect for the techniques, for the science, for the skill, for the discipline.
Before we go on to look at some of the chapters in the book, I just wanted you to say something about the illustrations there in it.
I was extremely fortunate to have a conversation with a lovely gentleman called Ross McFarland at the Wellcome Institute.
Friend
of all inquiring minds. You know, an extraordinarily generous man with his time, with his enthusiasm, and you know, I was very happy to thank him in Space Oracle, because I was talking about how I wanted to structure the book, and he said, actually, you know, Ken, in our archives at the Wellcome, we have an album of amateur astronomical drawings done in India ink and gouache and watercolour. I think they'd go really well with what you're writing. Come and have a look at it and see what you think. So, you know, I spent this wonderful afternoon with this very delicate 19th century volume of just the most exquisite astrological paintings of the various star signs. And the final person who gets a tribute paid to them at the end of Space Oracle is the unknown astronomer and painter who is responsible for the leaves of this album. There's a signature, but it defied my eye. But it does say the legend Church Lane, Stoke Newington, 1851. And they are perfect. They suit. I can't imagine the book now without these illustrations. And I wanted the last tribute of the book to be to this unknown individual and their work, you know, over 150 years ago. And I love the fact that they would never know that their work has suddenly appeared in a book like this in the 21st century. So there's hope for all of us.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Ken Hollings, and we're talking about his book, The Space Oracle, A Guide to Your Stars. And Ken, as I said, we're going to go through, you'll be glad to know, not all 12 of the houses.
I think the listeners will be glad to know not all 12.
I've chosen a few random thoughts on a few of them. The first one, which is the first one in the book, Scarab, as you've called it. Now, since the last time you were on this show, you were seriously ill.
Yes.
Now, there's a section in this first chapter set in a hospital, which I'm not 100% sure if they're related, but I presume they were.
I have a bit like our astrological body, various bits of me have had different problems. I've had several operations on different parts of my anatomy, but this was quite an early visit where I'd actually suffered a detached retina. And at the time I was working on, I did a series for Resonance 104.4 FM called Hollingsville, where I would interview people around a particular theme. And it was during one of these programs that I suddenly realized that my sight was going in my left eye. And so I had an operation to correct this. And because of the nature of the illness and because of the pressing need to have it done, I elected to have the operation done on my eye under a local anaesthetic rather than a general one. So I was actually awake all the way through this experience. And I thought this was a perfect way to start a history of astronomy with the eye. And it's also, not only do I get to give an account of this operation and the beautiful sounds that I heard while there were kind of various drills and sutures and lasers going on in my eyeball.
I did a
piece for Radio 3 actually about the sounds of that operation. But it's also it's an acknowledgement, because we start with the head, and I particularly start with the eye inside the head, because it's to remind everybody that this is where astronomy begins. In the eye. And I have, again, nothing but the greatest admiration for the generations of astronomers before the lens, Galileo kind of introduced the lens, but, you know, the lens was actually, you know, being ground in the Middle East, in Persia. But there is this long tradition of what was called oculo-nudo astronomy, which is
Sticking things in your eye. Basically.
Yeah, the naked eye, and how they would use planes and metal bars and walls and spheres. And quite often these things are monumental. They're huge because you don't want them to move. So the scale of oculo-nudo observation is gigantic. There are these amazing observatories in northern India. These were constructed so that they could correct and refine and revise the Hindu calendar. But these things are gigantic. You know, they're like small buildings in themselves, but they would allow you to observe Venus or Sirius or Mars or whatever it might be. And I just, as I said, it's my lack of sight is part of this homage to the people who had the patience to stare at some tiny point of light in the sky and say, oh, it's just moved a little bit more since last night, you know, and now it's beginning to go down, or now it's beginning to reverse its course for some reason. So yeah, Scarab also deals with the beginnings of the light itself. Like I pick Scarab because it's the scarab, the African dung beetle, which rolls up this ball of dung and then buries it with its eggs, and the eggs hatch out and they consume the dung, and so more beetles are born. And the Egyptian observer thought that this was a kind of metaphor for life itself, because it seemed like, what do they call it? Spontaneous generation, I think the alchemists call it. Like, suddenly, where have these things come from? And at the same time, I discovered that someone had done research on the scarab, and they discovered that the scarab navigates by the light of the Milky Way. So it actually is able to see polarized light, and it uses that light in order to sort of plot where it's going to leave these eggs, where this dung is going to be left. So I thought this beetle, this tiny creature, is already kind of navigating in a very, very precise way. And I just thought it was with my eye and the dung ball being sort of moved through space, and then the discovery that a lot of cosmonauts and astronauts, if they spend any protracted amount of time in space, a lot of them develop eye trouble, or cataracts, all kinds of things. And it's not unusual for people working in the International Space Station, certainly the Apollo astronauts, have all reported seeing sudden streaks of light and sudden points that seem to be kind of like whizzing across space. And it took a little while to realise that what they were seeing were actually cosmic rays moving through the fluid in their eyeball. So it just seemed like the place, you know, these are all starting points for me. And then as we sort of roll through the body, we continue our exploration of space through our physiology.
I want to talk about the chapter called Ishtab, and particularly your own first experience of a book, a representation of something called the Dresden Codex.
Yes, I don't normally write about myself in my work. If you look at my previous works, I'm very much someone who kind of absents themselves. Like I want the images to and the text to work for themselves. But because with the Space Oracle, I was looking at flat historical fact quite often, I discovered that the best way, the humane way to sort of like get into this world was actually through my own experiences. So I actually do appear at various points in the text itself, and mostly it's childhood or adolescence. So it's very about my development. And I did have this textbook which had a reproduction of the Dresden Codex, but it was a kind of modern, so some graphic designer had kind of redrawn it. And I remember being both frightened and fascinated by the depiction of these sky gods at war with heaven. And they're quite, you know, fascinating skull-faced creatures carrying heavy clubs.
This is a Mayan.
Yeah, this is a Mayan codex. It's one of the few surviving codices.
This in itself is an incredible story. So the Spanish basically destroyed
everything.
All of this, all of these books. Mm.
And these the Mayans were actually one of the first Central American civilizations to develop a written language. And they spent centuries observing the stars. They were more concerned, I love this, that they were more concerned about how they were located in time than they were in space. So the geography of where they were didn't interest them anywhere near as much as how the kind of span of their existence fitted into a larger kind of celestial narrative. So they wanted to know what all these points of light were telling them. And quite often these were recorded in from the surviving codices that we have, and there's about 9 of them, and they're all named after the cities, mostly in Europe, where they ended up. The Dresden Codex is one of the most famous ones, and these were just like folded papyrus sheets, almost like a roadmap or something, and you'd unfurl them. And I mean, the wonders of the internet, you can actually get a really beautiful high-definition PDF scan of the Dresden Codex, as I spent quite a bit of time not reading it, but sort of like looking through it. And I actually found the pages that I'd seen as a child in this old textbook, and I was absolutely thrilled. And it was a wonderful moment to see the actual, or you know, what the source material was, and also to discover Ishtab, who is this particularly unusual Mayan goddess. She is the goddess of suicides, and she's actually depicted as hanging by her neck. And the Mayans actually had a very, very different view of taking one's own life. They actually saw it as a kind of a graceful, noble thing to do. It was, you know, if you were faced with impossible odds, the decent thing, the best thing to do, the kindest thing would be to end your own life. And Ishtab would lead those who took their own lives. She would lead them to heaven. She would lead them to the good place. And I was puzzling about this. Like, why would suicide be something that you'd value? And then I realized that their view of the cosmos, their view of the cosmic calendar, as it were, was very closely aligned, as it was with a large number of cultures at this time, with growth and with the sort of cycles of fertility. You know, their view of the universe was a tree. It was, you know, the tree quite often appears as this kind of model, this growing structure that goes from under the ground through Earth up into the heavens. And so they had a very primitive, very basic form of agriculture, which was slash and burn. And so you needed to time that extremely precisely, because if you got it wrong, nobody eats, and there isn't a 7-Eleven that you can send out to. You know, that's it, there is no food. And it suddenly occurred to me that those that were prepared to sacrifice themselves, I could see why they would be considered noble in that sense. So I became fascinated by Ishtab, like this strange, almost seductive goddess who will also protect those who take their own lives.
Next, I wanted to talk about a section of the book which I thought was very you, and it's, and surprisingly, it's not even the one that features Godzilla.
Yeah.
The chapter Landsat, which basically sort of starts off an exploration of the, you know, the sort of advancing technologies in how we, I guess, that moment in history where we started to see images of the planet from outside. So we started to, you know, see those. We got further away from the U-2 spy plane to Sputnik out to actual satellites taking photographs of the Earth. And this develops into a exploration of the changing logo of Universal Pictures.
Yes. Yeah, I was particularly pleased with the way that sequence came out, because it's me trying to be an astronomer again. And, like, I know I'm not going to be very good with a telescope. Anyway, I live in a city. You know, there's so much pollution, I can barely see the stars. And so I decided to transform myself into an earthbound astronomer, observing how the Universal Pictures logo has changed over the 120 years of its existence. So I try and describe, you know, they have a basic formula, which is the name of the studio kind of appearing around a globe or a sphere. But over decades, this relationship has changed. So it was me trying to do a series of dispassionate descriptions of how this logo has, its orbit has kind of changed over this period of time.
And then just one more, we're nearly out of time, but the chapter, I said I was going to talk about this one, so I've got to get it in. The chapter Nebulae has, well, you know what we're going to talk about, so I'm not even going to ask you. You can just describe.
Okay, Nebulae. I knew I was going to get into trouble with this one, but I got very interested in what happens to wastewater in space, like what happens to our physiology. I mean, it's a big pressing issue, and in fact, the last chapter of Bright Labyrinth was called Living in Space, so that was the jumping off point into this book. And I was posing the question, like, if this is our destiny, if humanity is going to leave this world, then we're also going to have to change our physiology enormously. And one of the things, one of many problems, and there are many problems, is how do you go to the bathroom in space? What does this mean? And the starting point was, I'd read different accounts about what happens when they jettison urine and wastewater from the ISS or from an Apollo capsule. And apparently it is one of the most beautiful sights that you can see in the galaxy, because it's like hundreds of millions of little urine crystals just suddenly sort of just explode, and each one of them scintillates in the light, and apparently it's a gorgeous sight, this kind of amazing golden expanding globe. And there's beautiful examples of people observing a kind of wastewater dump from the International Space Station, and everyone going, what was that? Like this sudden brilliant streak of light across the sky. And I started tracing it back, and I discovered, for example, that because of the effects of microgravity, fluids in the body tend to sort of like even out. So that means that your kidneys get a hell of a battering when you're heading, you know, when you're leaving Earth's atmosphere and that our gravitational field. So apparently, one of the first things that that astronauts do is go to the bathroom, and you know, so that's one of the first things you're going to do. Yeah, after you've got over the awe and majesty of the site, it's like, all right, where's the loo? And I just kept pursuing this further and further. The thing that I loved was that I discovered I could trace it all the way back to Robert Hooke and his early studies. He had this theory about snowflakes. He believed that the individuality of each snowflake is the result of a perfect crystalline form falling through the atmosphere and getting battered by wind and rain and all the elements that of our material existence. So what we're seeing is a kind of imperfect rendering of a perfect form. And he was convinced, or had convinced himself, that the perfect form that he was analysing could be discovered by freezing human urine. So this is where he was getting his notion of what the crystal looked like, was from human urine. So I thought, wait a minute, there is literally a golden thread sort of running through this account. And every so often it does still, this theme kind of appears in other houses. So, for example, there is, I mean, I'm not obsessed about this. It's just when you start to sort of notice a pattern, you have to go with it. There is the Yuri Gagarin ritual where he is, you know, supposed to have when he was in the coach going out to the Vostok rocket for the first human flight into space, and he needs to go to the bathroom, so they actually have to stop the coach, and he gets out and somehow manages to relieve himself against the back wheel of the coach. And since then, it's one of these good luck rites that all astronauts do. Like, for example, women will sometimes take a glass vial of their own urine and just sort of throw it on the back wheel. And there is one cosmonaut actually said, you know, yes, we are, you know, as citizens of the Soviet Union, you know, obviously we don't believe in God, we don't believe in spiritual, metaphysical forces. But when it comes to superstitions like this, it's best to have everything on your side. So I love the fact that, yeah, we've checked everything, double checked it, triple checked it, quadruple checked it. But you know what? I'm hanging on to my lucky rabbit's foot. Or I'm going to do all these little rituals. And there are so many that take place at Baikonur. And I like it. It just almost is another form of astrology. It's another form of little rite that connects us or connects them in a positive, in a hopeful way, towards the heavens. So I'm kind of elevating urine in a way. Something that we don't think about, something that's banal and we all have to do. I'm sort of saying actually it connects us to the stars. It really, really does.
That's a great point for us to finish on. So I've been talking to Ken Hollins. We've been talking about his book, The Space Oracle, A Guide to Your Stars, which is out now from Strange Attractor Press. Ken, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
Thank you so much, Neil. Always a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.